Hello, and welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, speaking to you from here in Istanbul. Thanks for tuning in. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and the region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page. Follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and rate or review the podcast wherever you listen to it. Now here I also want to flag up a new addition, an exciting addition, to our membership system. As you may know, I stopped writing weekly reviews for the Hurriyet Daily News back in July. The archive of my reviews was still standing for a few months, but it now seems to have been deleted by somebody. And rather than let all that work just disappear, I've decided to give Turkey Book Talk members access to that archive of 231 reviews, which I wrote over the course of 5 years. The reviews cover a pretty diverse spread of subjects, from Turkish and international fiction and poetry to history, journalism, politics, the Middle East and Europe. I've packaged PDFs of the reviews in a zip folder and put them into categories, so the archive should be pretty easy to browse. Existing members have already actually received the archive via email, and if you sign up as a member, you'll also receive it along with all the other extras that a Turkey Book Talk membership brings. Full transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk, also in PDF form as soon as the episode is published. Members also receive transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive, which so far amounts to over 70 conversations and well over 200,000 words. The archive also includes a number of interviews not previously published on the podcast. Finally, members also get access to a very nice 30% discount on Turkey Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus. IB Taurus have a terrific archive of titles, and they've made over 200 books from their Turkey Ottoman history series, both academic and general interest, available at cut price, exclusive to Turkey Book Talk members, through a special discount code. A number of IB Taurus authors have appeared on the podcast so far, so becoming a member is a great way to get more acquainted with their work. To become a member and help us keep going, all you have to do is pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account, which you can find a link to at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, or of course by doing a Google search. As we post new episodes every 2 weeks, the monthly membership price is no more than $6. If you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then you'll certainly be more than welcome. But so long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members only get charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. And if you're not sure about it for yourself, why not consider signing up for a friend or colleague who may be interested? But now let's get cracking with our latest episode. In it we hear from Doğu Eroğlu. He's a journalist for the newspaper Bir Gün and the author of the book İşid Ağları, or ISIS Networks, Radicalization, Organization and Logistics in Turkey, which has just been published in Turkish by the İletişim Publishing House. The book takes us deep into the heart of ISIS's operations in Turkey. Eroğlu reports from the ground in neighborhoods blighted by radicalism, among recruits who have crossed the border to fight for ISIS, as well as family members and acquaintances they've left behind in Turkey. The book also looks at ISIS media operations, the clandestine cross-border weapons trade, and the state authorities' rather late crackdown on ISIS since 2015 and 2016. Overall, it's a really impressive and comprehensive book that's full of detail, researched and written with a calm, forensic approach. It would be great to have it in English, but at the moment, at least, it's only just been published in Turkish, and if you do read in Turkish, I'd absolutely recommend it. Doğu Eroğlu started reporting on ISIS networks in Turkey years ago, before the police started properly cracking down on the group, and I began by asking him to talk about what nudged him to turn his years of reporting into a book-length project.
I started working on the subject as a news reporter in Ankara in 2014, and the first place I visited was Hacı Bayram district. It was back then, it was quite famous because it was the one of the first radicalization hotspots that was discovered by the media. And when I arrived, there was already many reports on the subject, but they weren't very much deep down reports. They weren't indicating the reasons why the youth from that particular district was joining Islamic State or who was behind the recruitment. But I remember as a boy reading or hearing the broadcasts about PKK, and most of the news stories I read, like, those recruits were brainwashed without knowing it. And once I saw the same discourse about Islamic State recruits, I wanted to go there and see it by myself. So that's how it started. I went to Hacı Bayram district. For the listeners, I should describe it. It is a district very close to the old town of Ankara. It's in fact like 200 meters from the governorship of Ankara, but was sort of a center of an urban renovation project. So the citizens were sort of disenfranchised with the local municipality, and most of the youths were having some petty crime careers. They weren't able to find regular jobs due to their criminal records. With this knowledge, I tried to avoid myself having prejudgments. I wanted to talk to the recruits, talk to young boys in the neighborhood. I wanted to talk to families of the recruits and the eyewitnesses or citizens who are against or favoring the Salafi activities in the neighborhood. So after Hacı Bayram, I took that sort of approach to other towns in Turkey as well, to Konya, Kilis, Istanbul, Izmir, obviously Adıyaman and Gaziantep. I tried to keep the same attitude, no judgments before. So that was the part of the research. It also has a huge cross-checking effort of criminal investigations, some research into conflict literature and data-driven methods.
Obviously, you mentioned there that the book is based on a lot of first-hand reporting on the ground, contacting family members and acquaintances of people who've joined jihadi groups. It's also based on various kind of police records and court records. So there's a lot of material to cover. I mean, was it a challenge to arrange all of the sources into a book?
It really was. Now, after Turkey started to become the target of ISIS-related violence attacks, the administration increased its clampdown against such organizations. At least some decent criminal investigations were made. So I had a huge resource from courts, from the police work, wiretapping records, of course. Well, I started reading those wiretapping records as early as 2015, as the first criminal investigations were surfacing back then. But only after 2 years, well, I become safe to say that I understood what the coded messages embedded into those phone conversations was. So I had to spend time on the field. I had to spend time reading about the accused official statements so that I could get a glimpse at the larger picture.
And obviously the subject is very sensitive as well, and the personal thing for many of the people that you're talking to. I mean, did you get what kind of response did you get as you were reporting? Was there a negative thing, or were there threats from anywhere that came along? You were not really sort of undercover at any point. You never concealed your identity, so everything was fairly open. I wonder how that went down really with the people that you were reporting.
Right. It is a sensitive issue for both the state and the related other parties, being the ex-fighters, the families of jihadists, or even the people who share the same neighborhood. But I think the hardest part of my research on the ground was conducting the research with the presence of the state and of the security apparatus. I mean, the police didn't really want any contact with those neighborhoods. So I had to conceal my identity from them if I required that. But apart from that, I never went undercover the whole time. I introduced myself as a journalist, and I think the mutual curiosity had enabled me to talk to many of the Salafists I managed to meet. Of course, I received a lot of negative feedbacks from the families, from the fighters or Mujahideen themselves. You have to be prepared for receiving some harsh answers when you're out there and looking for some parties to talk. There were some instances, especially worth remembering for me, especially the family of Rashid Tural was not pleasant after Rashid was confirmed to be killed during the bombardments. But other than that, after the publication of the book, I didn't really receive huge criticism or negative feedback from the Salafi community. Some Islamist circles I saw on social media found the book thorough, and they sort of think that I made a thorough analysis without having a hostile tone. So that makes me happy. Of course, some people resented that I put their names on the book, but since their names appeared on public investigations, it is allowed for any publisher to quote them.
And I mean, this is very sensitive stuff, and especially in the current environment in Turkey, you know, for obvious reasons. And a lot of people really are surprised, actually, that a book like this can even come out. I mean, are you also surprised? Were you worried about what kind of reaction the book would get? And what kind of reaction is your work kind of drawing from the authorities?
Well, that's a huge question mark for me until now, too. I haven't really met or received any feedback from the state side, but I think they're the obvious ones who should make good use of the book, because even if they know or they have much greater information than me, obviously, they can analyze which parts of their struggle against radical extremism are perceiving as failures or successes. So I think which really surprised me throughout the whole process, starting from 2014, was the low level of cooperation between state and press or researchers who are working in this field. There were only some instances that I was being asked by any prosecutor about further information. So I think there might be some new inquiries after some more time. I think it's still early to expect some reaction from the authorities. But I don't really expect an indictment or a terror case against the book or my research.
Now, the book is divided into a number of sections, and many of those sections examine a specific area or city or province. We mentioned a bit earlier the Hagi Bayram neighborhood in Ankara, and your kind of chapter on Hagi Bayram is the first chapter in the book. And Hagi Bayram became notorious for the number of people being radicalized and joining militant groups in Syria. But it's also got a bit of a history going back to the early 90s that you talk about with, you know, Al-Qaeda and Salafi groups kind of planting roots there, and it was these groups that kind of almost laid the groundwork for the later generation that emerged with the war in Syria. I want to talk about the push factors behind what motivated a lot of recruits to ISIS in the last few years in Hagi Bayram particularly. Seemed to me, as I was reading, like Hagi Bayram, probably more than anywhere else that you talk about in the book, there's this very strong element of like social deprivation, drugs and poverty. And you mentioned a bit before, you know, this urban transformation project that was going on there, still going on there, that has also had kind of social ramifications. And just could you talk about that aspect of the jihadi profile in Hagi Bayram, first of all?
I think I should summarize how I approach each and every radicalization hotspot I visited. Well, in the radicalization part of the book, you described that there are some chapters devoted for different cities. The radicalization part looks for some properties in each radicalization hotspot I have visited. When I write about Ankara, Istanbul, Adana, Konya, Adıyaman, and Gaziantep as featured areas, it doesn't mean Salafist radicalization was limited to those cities, but those cities could be characterized with one or more radicalization narratives. Different set of social relations embedded into them, different biographies for possible recruits. And while I write about those cities and radicalization hotspots specifically, I try to answer who are those radicals and what are the shared features of their biographies, and what are the driving factors, what are the surrounding conditions in their neighborhoods or in their cities. What do recruiters do to radicalize those people? This enfranchisement is a huge factor for all the radicalization hotspots I visited. That's a common narrative. And apart from disenfranchisement and the widening gap between the state and the citizen relations, I can say some distinct narratives I find in Istanbul, for example, the hatred towards Kurdish groups. Also, in some areas where identity for young men was a huge problem, that I saw some dichotomies that recruiters wanted to use, that the responsibility for the ummah was very important and they should exercise jihad to not become sinners. In some other area, for example, as we talked, Hagi Bayram, that discourse was changed something into like a cleansing motive, because those people there, those young people there, were already into bad habits from the point of view of Islam. Drugs. The addiction to drugs was not a push factor for jihadists, but recruiters. The recruiters used that as a discourse so that the potential recruits to feel the obligation to join jihad.
What about numbers? I mean, it's hard to give a really specific figure, but how many thousands of Turkish ISIS fighters were there? And how many were killed? How many returned? I mean, do we have any concrete figures about this? Do the authorities have those numbers?
Well, I bet authorities have a better estimate, but it's very hard for anyone to answer that question. I think we should take the toll from the beginning of the Syrian civil war, because there was obviously some changes of allegiances from the beginning of the Syrian civil war. The first recruits going there pledged their allegiances to Al-Qaeda proxies. And then as the Islamic State's probability of success increased, they changed sides to Islamic State. But as a total figure, at least 4,000 had traveled to Syria and Iraq, either to fight as combatants or residents. But 4,000, we should include their families and social networks when making an estimation about the Salafist community in Turkey. So I would say at least 20 to 30,000 people are currently in relation with Salafist networks in Turkey. The recruitment procedures in Turkey had happened mainly on social networks. Social networks being kinship, the friendship, colleagues recruiting them, other colleagues, or young people from neighborhoods inviting their friends, their school friends to radicalization gatherings. So it all happens in social networks in Turkey. But when we see the former methods Al-Qaeda utilized in Western countries, it was more of a headhunting, indicating a vulnerable person in social groups like schools, sports clubs, or mosques. But in Turkey, it didn't work that way. So I would say 4,000, more or less, traveled to Syria and Iraq in this civil war. But we should count their social networks as potential members of Salafist networks as well.
Yeah, one thing that comes through the book definitely is this, you kind of emphasize a number of times, you know, the importance of like local institutions, really, you know, local like unofficial masjids, local kind of flats that have been kind of taken over by groups, and then they're used as mechanisms to radicalize or to recruit. And there's a lot of talk, you know, for years there's been a lot of stuff spoken about online radicalization and sort of individuals self-radicalizing almost. But you kind of do emphasize the importance of social networks and really concrete ties, concrete relationships between people rooted in local communities.
That is a nice point to underline. I know that online radicalization or self-radicalization exists in Turkey or existed throughout the whole Syrian civil war. But what I saw in my research, it is if it exists, it is very rare. 9 out of 10 times there should be a recruiter who's watching over the radicalization phases, acting as a mentor to the potential recruit. It could be either an individual davet, davet is like invitation, but in Salafist literature it's called dawa. So either the individuals could be invited to the cause individually by one by mentors, or in most cases, as it happened in Turkey, collectively, like one speaker at a gathering in a masjid or any other place disguised as a shop in the middle of a neighborhood. A speaker telling about the current conditions of Syrian civil war and what should a Muslim feel as obligation to do at such hard times. So most of the radicalization happened that way, as far as I see during my research. There are a lot of Salafist communities in Turkey, and if you are on track of radicalization during the time between 2014 and 2017, you could easily ask for where was the closest gathering to you throughout the Islamic State media in Turkish. There are some examples, some curious people asking Islamist Salafist websites about where can they find Salafist communities. And throughout the conversation, if the owners or the administrators of those websites trust that particular individuals, they reveal or they invite them to the closest gathering. So it starts as a curiosity or self-recruitment, but then most of the cases in Turkey turns to be a part of that collective invitation.
And one character that you profile in the book is Rashid Tural, and his story of radicalization is very striking indeed, and could almost be turned into a film, you imagine. Like, he was this very successful astrophysics student at Middle East Technical University in Ankara, one of the most prestigious universities in Turkey. He went abroad, he went to Finland, I think, and he studied, I think he traveled to America as well. And in the book, you describe the story of how he just gradually became radicalized from this very promising, very smiling student, and he ended up going to fight for ISIS. Just tell us about this character, Rashid Tural, his life, you know, his biography, and what happened to him.
As you said, he's a very peculiar example to our general notion of a potential candidate for radicalization or potential combatant. But that's why I found Rashid Tural's story very important. When the public first knew about Rashid, they thought that was another anomaly, that was another fault along the way, while he was studying in Middle East Technical University, studying physics, and how he went to Finland as a potential astrophysicist. Physicist, and he should have happy with his life because he was a promising candidate to become a good astrophysicist and etc. But the public wants to see those examples as an anomaly, always as a cartoon or caricaturize all profiles of Salafist recruits. So I wanted to tell Rashid's story in depth to show that anyone who made contact with a recruiter or a self-radicalized group with right biography could be a recruit. So it is harsh for his friends, for his family, to see that Rashid chose such a path. But if there are some people around you that can utilize your own biography against you, I mean, to utilize your biographical details to radicalize you, or you find yourself in a group that is obsessed with the righteous cause of any non-state armed group, you can end up radicalized. So Rashid is a good example how Salafist radicalization can and it might affect Turkish society in the future.
Now, the security authorities really only started cracking down on ISIS networks very late on, in sort of summer 2015, really. It's very belated indeed. And it was also related very much to kind of changing calculations in Syria and the emergence of this threat. How do you assess this crackdown? You know, how successful has it been? Why was it left so late? And what have been the effects of it?
I can turn back to Hacı Bayram to answer that again. When I was in Hacı Bayram, during my first visits to neighborhood, I saw that there was a police station next to neighborhood. I mean, 50 meters to where it all happened. So I found that odd, the whole radicalization phase is being exercised under the nose of the police. But I soon found out that police was not really interested into meddling into this stuff. There were political motives, of course, of this turning a blind eye to all those. But from my opinion, Turkey learned a lesson in a hard and sad way. As the Gaziantep cell network began its violence campaign in Turkey, Turkish security apparatus and intelligence listed those who got radicalized in Adıyaman as prime suspects. Everyone remembers how it went from that. After all, the assailants of IED attacks to HDP's Diyarbakır rally and the gathering in Suruç in June 2015 were from Adıyaman. And a security campaign had put in effect against Adıyaman radicals who left their homes and joined Islamic State ranks in 2014. Pictures were distributed to local police and to the media, and everybody was looking for them. Only after Ankara attack on October 2015, which was carried out by another jihadist from that cell, from Adıyaman, the security apparatus understood that the actual perpetrator of those attacks was the Gaziantep cell indeed. So that was a huge profiling lag because of the early disinterest of Turkish security apparatus into the recruitment efforts. It was found out by mistake too, because the police found out that the suicide bombers who were brought to Ankara by cars are from Gaziantep. Even after that intel, it took months for the designers of those attacks being captured in Gaziantep. Immediately after the Ankara explosion, the next popular jihadist attacker profile became the Gaziantep cell members. Instead of former Adıyaman recruits, they now went after Gaziantep cell members. But then in 2016, the attacks carried out were perpetrated by foreign nationals. Everyone remembers the Istanbul Atatürk airport attack and Reina attack, and some other attacks in Istanbul were carried out by foreign nationals. And both attacks were very hard to be avoided for the police because of this profiling lag I've been mentioning. This, if the security apparatus had monitored Islamic State border activity and the activities of local Islamic State cells, those attacks could have been easily averted. For starters, police would have known the connection between Adıyaman radicals and Gaziantep cell structure. But all these attacks taught the security apparatus that there are many Salafist communities in Turkey, including the foreign nationals. And having no prior information about those communities made Turkey very vulnerable to that sort of security threats. So they started their clampdown over those communities very late, and those clampdowns were very ineffective at the beginning. But now I can see that they're more serious and they know what to look, what to go after. And I can understand that the administration is aware of potential future threats. Just looking at the potential conflict in Idlib and the administration's approach to a possible influx of refugees, it shows the security worries over such an influx. So I can say that though it's late, now the Turkish state had finally came to senses and doing a more serious job.
Yeah, I think 2016 was a nadir in a way. There was just a series of attacks. It seemed like every week there was something, and there was a kind of spiral. It looked like it was going out of control, and a lot of that, I think, was probably sourced from the fact that this crackdown was very belated. But right. It's funny, like since the Reina attack at 2016-2017 New Year, there really hasn't been any ISIS attacks staged on any targets, it seems, or only very small ones. I mean, do we have an idea of the number of attacks that have been prevented so far? Or?
There were some figures announced by the Interior Ministry that number of attacks were prevented, but I'm not sure how we can trust those figures. I agree with the tendency after Reina attack that most of the attacks or the initiatives for attacks have been seized. So I think there are two factors for this. The first being the better security provided by the state. And I think the more influential factor is the state of Islamic State after 2017. It kind of had to deal with its existential crisis. Rather than threatening possible enemies such as Turkey, they had to deal with their shrinking sovereignty over land in Syria and Iraq. So I think there were many distractions for Islamic State as well.
You also mentioned, I mean, there was always, and there still is, like, a lot of accusations, you know, Turkish authorities, you know, cooperated with ISIS and, you know, partnered with them, particularly in previous years. I mean, you are very suspicious about that, those kind of accusations. Just could you just comment on how you approach those accusations?
Right. So, of course, there might be some legitimate claims that security apparatus overlooked at some points before the attack in Ankara on October 10, 2015, or the Suruç attack or the Diyarbakır attack. Those are all legitimate claims. But so far, we don't really have any concrete evidence that the Turkish state had some sort of partnership with the Islamic State cells. So it is very hard to prove. And I believe there are no ways of proving that with undeniable evidence. So instead of being fixated on such possibilities on event by event basis, attack by attack basis, the public should ask the lack of general prevention before all those attacks.
One of the points that you stress very much in the book is the lack of de-radicalization policies in Turkey. You know, there's certainly been a crackdown and police pressure and, you know, many detentions and convictions, but there's absolutely no policy or strategy about how to deal with the problem in the years ahead. Just talk about this lack of de-radicalization strategy and what that means going forward.
To ensure a safe environment after this Syrian civil war, I think what authorities should have done at the beginning of the return of the fighters, and fighters started to return effectively in 2015 as the bombardments of anti-ISIS coalition increased. I think they should have started rehabilitation programs at correctional facilities for the first thing. But many jihadists, many returnee fighters went through no investigation in 2015. They just came back to Turkey, and some of them were charged for illicit crossing of borders, and some didn't even face such charges and return their lives. After 2016, as you mentioned, the level of security and clampdowns increased. So those people started to be persons of interest to the security apparatus. But it was sort of late and ineffective, and it didn't include any soft measures for rehabilitation, for reintroduction to the society. I remember meeting one fighter, and he gave a very vivid account of what he went through as a Islamic State recruit, and it included severing heads, killing people. And while he was telling me all those stuff he did as a Islamic State fighter, his voice was trembling. His hands were shaking, and well, he was basically crying, and I immediately noticed that he was suffering some sort of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. It is a huge probability that most of the ex-fighters are suffering some sort of stress after the conflicts they have been through, and I think the reintroduction to public in such conditions is posing a future threat to all societies in Turkey. Because Turkey is a country full of problematics about free speech, and I don't want any member of the society to feel the pressure upon themselves that each time they voice a concern or an unpopular idea, they shouldn't worry that some ex-fighter with PTSD could want to have a confrontation with them. So I think that's a huge worry for the remainder of the society, that any de-radicalization measure is missing throughout this whole legal procedure. As far as I know, I have never heard any additional measures to convicted Islamic State members as well. I still see that they stay at the same rooms in correctional facilities. They're not offered any sort of help once they are released. Or I see that some influential figures amongst the Turkish-speaking Salafist community has been released, and they are very much freely continue their propagandist activities, probably except Abu Hanzala, one of the most influential figures. He's still in jail, and he's going to be serving 13 years of time. But apart from him, the other influential figures continue their work and continue to work with their communities. They're trying to keep their communities intact after the hype of war is missing. The communities are trying to find new ways to stay together. So they keep doing that.
And over the years, I mean, the we mentioned Idlib earlier, and this potentially could see a new wave of fighters coming in to the country. And there's already, you know, over the years, as the Syrian war has gone on, there has been, as well as the ISIS militants killed, there's also been a lot of people moving back into Turkey. And there's a lot of talk about sleeper cells or people who do maybe, as you mentioned, have some kind of post-traumatic stress as well, potentially metamorphosizing into something, you know, more threatening in the future. I mean, is that something that we should be worried about, or...
Well, that is a possibility, of course. During the reign of Islamic State was very influential because it managed to become a sovereign ruler over some particular land, and it promised a new life for potential recruits or potential members, potential citizens, I should say. And it lured huge numbers of population all over the world, and Turkey was no different. So if another jihad becomes that promising, if another attempt for the Islamic State, the Islamic State, I mean the caliphate, not the Islamic State that reigned in Syria and Iraq, if such an attempt seems promising, we can see another wave of fighters leaving Turkey. Or if Turkey becomes some sort of a point of attraction for Salafists in the future, we can see a different movement. We can see an influx of Salafists. That is a potential threat that the administration has to deal with, because during the Syrian civil war procedure, those Salafist communities become bigger and more effective than they have ever been. So I see that they have started to become more influential over their Western counterparts, and they're trying to become some sort of center of gravity, at least for Balkans, for former Soviet republics. So yeah, we can see they can strategically become something else than what they are now. They are now, most of them are local communities, but with the influence, with the enlargement they experienced during this Syrian civil war, they can turn to some other things.
That was Dolwer Olu. Many thanks to him. Remember to consider signing up as a Turkey Book Talk member. And also remember that from now on there's a new addition to the membership system. The archive of 231 reviews that I wrote over 5 years until this summer for the Hurriyet Daily News. The reviews cover subjects ranging from Turkish and international fiction and poetry to history, journalism, politics, the Middle East and Europe. And because they no longer exist online, from now on a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access them. Of course, members also get access to transcripts in English and Turkish of every interview as it's published, as well as transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive of over 70 conversations so far. Members are also able to get a hefty 30% discount on a catalogue of over 200 books on Turkey and Ottoman history published by IB Taurus. To become a member, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account, and if you're personally not sure, then why not consider signing up as a gift for a friend or colleague who may be interested. Also, do please rate or review Turkey Book Talk on iTunes or whatever podcast platform you use. You can follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay fully updated with new episodes, and you can send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.